this guy was not an Eastern Tour guy, and he paid with his own money, is what I heard with the grapevine. So I immediately said to myself, who is this guy? I've got to meet this guy. So I started tracking him down. And I finally got a hold of the guy, and I called him up and I said, my name's Alan Proctor, we've never met. Let's have coffee at Sammy's. So we sat down at Sammy's, and I looked him right in the eye, and I said, why are you doing this? What do you hope to accomplish? What's behind it? And I looked him in the eye, and I saw that this guy was sincere. This guy was real. This guy wanted to do it. This guy wanted to make a difference. And even though he said to me, I don't have the contacts, I don't have all the background, but we have to do it. We must do it. I said to myself, I'll help this guy. I'll help you. That guy was your Rabbi Daniel Korn. So that's who you have leading you. You have a very special, very unique person, and you should greatly appreciate it. About 20 years ago, there was an air conditioning company that held their annual convention. Now, if you've ever been to an annual sales convention, you know what they do is they bring the top producers up on stage and they give them an award. Well, in this company, this is a real story. In this company, they brought up the top salesman, and this guy started to shoot off his mouth about how great a salesman he was. He can put everybody to shame. The managers don't know what they're doing. And of course, the managers got very upset at this. So they said to themselves, we're going to fix this guy. We're going to send this guy to the worst possible sales territory in America to sell air conditioners. So where do you think they sent him? They sent him to Alaska. Okay, real story. They sent him to Alaska. Next year, they came back to the sales convention, and this guy was still the number one salesman in America. So now they said, okay, now you get up and you tell us what you did. Now, that's fine. You can shoot off your mouth, whatever you like. So he said, let me ask you a question. He said, sales is about meeting the needs of people, understanding what they want, not trying to push what we want to sell. He said, let me ask you something. What comes out of the back of an air conditioner when you turn it on? Heat. He said, I turned it around and I sold it as a heater. It's a true story. It's a great story. It's one of the greatest sales marketing stories I've ever heard. So why did I start with that story from the book Guerrilla Marketing? I started with this story because the goal of tonight's talk is to help people reframe perhaps the way that they understand the non-from world. For lack of a better word, I'm going to use the word non-from world instead of not yet from world. There are lots of different expressions, but it's just to keep it simple. I want to help you understand the mentality of where people are coming from, because I, as a Baal Tshuva myself, I've certainly been there. And number two, I want to help you understand some of the goals of reaching out. I know with Gershon Fern and Rabbi Korn, etc., there's a lot of emphasis spoken about how to reach out and why to reach out. I want to help frame it in the perspective of some goals. At the end, I'll take questions. Now, I've been in sales and marketing for over 20 years, and the single greatest lesson I have ever learned in sales is that there are only two reasons why people don't do anything in life. Why they don't become from, why they don't go to Eretz Israel, why they don't get married, why they don't, you fill in the blank, why they don't do anything. I'm not talking about from a spiritual perspective, I'm talking about from a physical perspective. There are only two reasons why they don't do anything. This is actually a 3-hour sales seminar that I'm going to try to condense down into a lot less than that for tonight. The only two reasons why people don't do anything in life is that either they have too much fear or they lack perceived value. They have too much fear or they lack perceived value. So let's take an example and I'll prove it to you. Let's suppose that we ran a marketing company and we decided that we were going to get the police to close off Forche Road over here on both ends, and we took a plank of wood 100 yards long and 6 feet wide, and we laid it down in the road, and again, the road was all closed off, And a crowd of people gathered around, and we said, for the first 100 people that walk across this plank that's on the road, we will give you $100. How many people do you think we can get to walk across that plank? We'll get 100, right? What's the big deal? You just walk 100 yards, pick up your $100 bill. There it is. Take it. Thank you very much. Now, let's suppose that we change just one factor. We take that 100-yard plank and we perch it on the top of what used to be the World Trade Center. Now, how many people are going to walk across the plank? Probably a couple of nuts, right? There's always a couple of nuts somewhere that'll do something for $100. Why? What changed? The fear went up massively. That's the only thing that changed. Same $100, same plank of wood, same size, same everything. The fear went up massively. Now, let's suppose that our marketing company had a goal to try to get close to 100 people to walk across that plank, even perched on the top of the World Trade Centers. What are some of the things that we can do to get more people to walk across the plank? Any ideas? I'm sorry? The railing. Excellent. Put a railing across the sides of the board. Will more people do it? Sure. Okay, what else can we do?
Increase the compensation.
Right. Now it's not $100. Now it's $100 million. More people do it? Absolutely.
They would crawl across.
Yeah, they would crawl across. Correct. What else could we do?
They can prove that it's not risky.
Okay, if they can prove that it's not risky. Let's say, so give me an example of how they could prove that it's not risky.
There are stories of many people who did it, and they got through it alive.
Okay, so let's say they told stories of people that did it and got through it alive. Might a few more people do it? Sure. What else could we do?
Safety net.
Oh, excellent. So now we put a huge safety net about 10 feet below it, a big reinforced safety net like they use in the circus, right? Will more people do it? Okay. What else can we do? How about if we harness the person in? We put him in a harness, and we attach that harness with a pulley to a helicopter hovering above him. And it holds him in. And now he still has to walk, but he's harnessed in. More people do it? Right. Now we tell him, we're going to put your picture on the front of every newspaper in the world as the bravest person in the world. More people do it? A few more people do it. Okay. We could play this out for a few hours, and you would see that every single answer we're going to come up with either involves decreasing their fear or increasing their perceived value. So let's go through some of the answers we gave. We put up a railing. Did we decrease their fear or increase their perceived value?
Decrease their fear.
We made it not $100, it's $100 million. Increase the value. We harnessed them into the helicopter. Decrease fear, increase value. Decrease fear. We put the net underneath. Decrease fear, increase value. Decrease fear. We told them, your picture goes on the front of every newspaper in the world. Decrease fear, increase value. Increase value. Again, I'm condensing a long seminar into just a few minutes, but I think you get the idea. You can play this out with anything you want. Just like we say, all 613 mitzvos fit in the Aseres Adibros somewhere. Every single reason a person will ever give you for not reaching out, or if they're on the other side of the equation, for not taking your tape, going to your class, listening to your Devar Torah, whatever it happens to be, is either because they have too much fear or they lack perceived value. That's one of the main points that I'd like you to walk away with tonight. Okay. Let me try to give you a little bit of a framework of where most non-from people are coming from. If I would bring up 10 reform, conservative, reconstructionist, et cetera, people on the stage, and there was, let's say, a blank screen here so they couldn't see anybody, and I said, let's be honest. Can we be honest? What do you think the Orthodox think of you? You know what we're going to hear? They think I'm no good. They think I'm a goy. They think I'm a sinner. They think they're better than me, that I'm less than. They think that I don't care. This is what we're going to hear. Okay? Now, if somebody feels that way, even if it's not true, right? Because most of us don't really feel that way, but that is the perception out there. Believe me, I read all the periodicals of all the different groups. That's how they feel, the vast majority. Do you think it's going to be easy for them to want to grow in Yiddishkeit, in Torah? No. So the very first step is helping people feel accepted. Helping people feel not judged. You know who is tremendous at this? Chabad. If you read the book, The Rebbe's Army, if you read anything that Lubavitch puts out, you will see that they, over and over again, the people that are interviewed, the people that go to Chabad at Harvard University, wherever it happens to be, they all say the same thing. They're non-judgmental. They're very accepting. They're very open. I'm not here to debate pros and cons of Chabad. That's a different discussion. They do a lot of things right, and they have tremendous Mesiras Nefesh and tremendous Avos Yisrael in my experience. I'd like to say a Peshat. This is me, Alan Proctor's Peshat, from something we read in last week's Parsha. I've never heard this from a Rav, what have you, because I believe it's accurate from my experience. Ani Yosef Ha'od Avichai. That Yosef, the moment that Yosef identifies himself, even to himself, as Yosef and not as second in command in Mitzrayim, you know the first thing he wants to know? Ha'od Avichai. Is my father in heaven still thinking of me? Does he love me? That's my personal take from that pasuk. That when it really boils down to it, many non-frum Jews want to know, does God think about me? Does he care about me? Or doesn't he? Very important point. We're going to get more to it a little bit later. I find that there are misconceptions in parts of the frum world about non-frum people. I find from speaking to people that sometimes we believe that non-frum are kineged Torah. They're really against Torah. They don't want anything to do with it. They know, and they've chosen not to. And so, I don't want it. It's not accurate. Most people are just very ignorant today. Number two, they're not interested. They're not interested. There's nothing. A lot of them are interested, and we're going to get to that. Number three, they think that we're weird. We wear this, we wear tzitzis, we make brachas, we leave early on Friday afternoon, what have you. There may be a perception that they think we're weird and it's a whole different world. No. There are a certain amount of non-frum people out there that look at a Torah lifestyle with respect. And there's also somewhat of a misconception that a lot of non-frum people are totally happy and they're totally fulfilled and they're making money and they're traveling and they're doing all these great things. The reality is that the only true pleasure in life is closeness to God. Anything else physical is not pleasure. It's escape from pain. It's escape from pain. We live in a society where sports pretty big these days. You can't go a day in the 365-day calendar without baseball, football, basketball, Rose Bowl, college, this, that, World Series. So it's unbelievable. A person can hear sports 24/7 and it never ends. And they all got caught up in it. Okay? People do a lot of things today to escape the emptiness inside. There's a great expression that says, you can't fill an inside void with outside things. You can't fill an inside void with outside things. And a lot of people try to do that. One of the greatest vorts I ever heard about Kirov was from my Rav, Rav Nachum Chaimowitz, in Yerushalayim. And he said to me, Aaron Levy, he said, there are basically three types of Jewish people out there. Three types of non-from Jewish people out there. He said, number one, there are those who are looking for something. Number two, there are those who are caught up in the taivas of the world. And number three, there are those who have blocks or issues. Now let's take them one at a time. Those who are looking for something. Rav Chaimowitz said to me, the people who are looking for something will eventually find something. They'll find Chabad, they'll find Ur Sameach, they'll find Isha Torah, they'll find Jeff Seidel at the Kotel, they'll find something somewhere eventually. Now, those of you who are of my generation know that a lot of people in the 1960s and 70s went looking for that something in the Far East. You even see that happening today with a lot of Israelis. They finish their obligatory army service and they take off to Indonesia, Taiwan, India, China. They're looking for something else, but they don't know what that thing is. If we can understand that that's primarily what they're doing, they'll say they go there because it's cheap and it's far away, and it is cheap and it is far away. But that's only a part of it. The deeper part is they're looking for that spirituality, that ruchnius. So the people that are looking are the primary ones that we want to focus on. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. Category two, those who are caught up in the tithes of the world. Rav Chaim Lurie said the reality is that many of the Jewish people today, the non-from Jewish people today, fit in that category. The tithes of the world could mean guy works on Wall Street, making a ton of money, at least up until a few months ago, right? Making a ton of money, traveling, jewelry, cars, sports, vacation, this, dinner, out, everything. And boy, that guy looks good and smells good, and he and his wife or his girlfriend, his kids, whatever, they're just having a great time, just enjoying life. And if a person has money and everything is going well and comfortable, there's a lot of things a person can spend their time and money and enjoyment to. There are more countries to go to. You can fly here and fly there and sports and plays and Broadway and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A person that's in that matzav, generally, we have to leave alone. Rav Chaim Lurie taught me that Hashem has to wake that person up. In fact, some people might say that 9/11 was a wake-up call in a certain way to perhaps particularly that group. That the tsunami from a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, that killed 233,000 people, Rahman al-Islam, that was a wake-up call. Hashem gives us wake-up calls. We have to wake up. And you have to realize with a person who's in that category, it's not us. And it's not even Torah so much. I'll give you an example. Let's say that I had a hot, juicy steak here, delicious steak, galat kosher from Prime Grill. And I came up to a person and I said, would you like this steak? And he says, oh, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I'm starved. Oh, that looks great. Take the steak, right? But let's say I came up to the same person and he said, oh, I just finished a huge meal. I just ate so much. I stuffed myself. I cannot eat another bite. We say, but look, a steak. Look at this. Glad kosher prime. Oh, it smells good. What can I tell you? I don't have room for it. I take a little piece, maybe, but that's all I could take. Right? Does that have any bearing on the quality of the steak? Nothing. The steak is still a tremendous steak. Lahavdil Aleph Abdullah's Torah is still tremendous, the best, glad kosher, etc., etc. The guy's not hungry. The guy's not looking. We're going to talk about that. Number three, people who have blocks or issues. Sometimes you run across people, and if you can get them talking long enough, they'll say, well, I read in the newspaper that this Orthodox Jew got caught stealing or embezzling money or cheating. Or I used to work for a guy, he was an Orthodox Jew, and he did such and such and such. Chas v'shalom. Right? That puts a tremendous block in that person's mind. Well, if this guy's Orthodox and he has Torah, and Torah is supposed to be it, and Torah is what you want to sell me, so to speak, how do you explain it? That's a tough one. Or they have a bigger kasha, tzadik v'ralo, rasha v'tovlo type of thing. How do you explain that bad things happen to good people? Maybe, God forbid, something happened to one of the kid's children, got sick or something. And he says, how can there be a God? Or they have a Holocaust question. Or they say, you know, when I was younger, I was in yeshiva, and the Rebbe used to smack me. So if Judaism is like that, I don't want it. I'm not interested. That guy's going to have an emotional block. Those people can be worked with. Now, most of us lay people don't have the ability and the Torah knowledge and the psychology to help those people very much. So my recommendation is to say to yourself, let me see if I can get this guy connected to someone who can help them. And the best way to do that, I found, is if he says, well, how do you explain the Holocaust, let's say, right? How are we going to tackle such a question? The answer is, there is an explanation. I'm not good at explaining it. Let me see if I can give you a book or a website or a person to speak to or something that may begin to give you a little satisfaction on the topic. That usually, a person says, that there is an explanation? You just, okay. You don't pretend that you know it all? Okay, fine. I'll take a little something. Okay. The most important point I'd like you to walk away from here tonight with, and this is my experience, 12 years going through the Teshuva process and being involved in the Kiruv field. This is my experience, is that only about 10 to 20% of non-Frum people at any given time are looking. Okay? Why do I tell you that and emphasize that and even risk putting a number up to you? Because I found, listening to different people who really want to reach out, that there is a tendency to think, I've got to get everybody. This guy at work, I got to get him. This guy who's my dry cleaner, I got to get him. The guy in the cab, I got to get him. The guy on the airplane, I got to get him. 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 But you talk to him and you just see the light is not on. Or they're in group two, they're caught up in the tithes of the world. Or something else is going on in their life and they're just not open. You know what? That's okay. That's normal. That's normal. Approximately 10 to 20% of the non-firm world at any given time is open and looking. I just read a statistic last night that 30 to 40,000 birthright students come back from Israel every single year. That's a lot of kids, age 18 to 26, 30 to 40,000. And the quote from the birthright people was, they say 10 days was great, day 11, now what? Now what? What do we do? And they describe it as a tremendous jump off the abyss. So now some philanthropists are starting to put up money to do follow-up programs. But if you'd run across such a kid, he may even be in the work world at age 24, 25, 26. And they just went to Israel and the neshama was sparked and so forth. That's a person generally that's very open that you can have a conversation with. Because the reality is, and we've all heard the statistics, that out of the approximately 5.5 million Jews in America, there are about 5 million who aren't from and about 500,000 who are. So even if only 10% of the non-from are looking, we still need every single one of you to do something. Every single one. Even if it's only 10%. And there is definitely an epidemic of ignorance out there in the Frumvelt of the giganticness, enormity of the problem. But slowly and hopefully as we do more and more of these trainings, the word will get out and people will begin to realize of how big it is. But you know what? It can be conquered. And we can deal with it. And the reality is if we work on focusing on that 10 to 20% and we meet their needs, and they little by little sort of join our ranks or they start to grow in Torah, then there's going to be another 10 to 20%. And now those guys are, so to speak, already on our team. And they're going to try to reach out to their friends, relatives, neighbors, etc., etc. So the momentum can gain very quickly. Let's speak a little bit about the goals of reaching out. Very, very, very important to let people know that we care about them. I'm going to talk from here on out, I'm going to talk a lot about letting people know we care, sincerity, and being real about Avos Yisrael. We have to be real that there are non-Jewish groups out there that are targeting, so to speak, the 5 million non-from Jews. I read an incredible article about a group of missionaries in Tiberias, next to the northeast of Eretz Yisrael. And what they do is they take Russian olim, Russian immigrants who have made aliyah. They came, they left prestigious jobs, many of them, doctors, physicists. They come, now they're getting meager jobs. And they come and they befriend them. Oh, we love you. Welcome. So nice to see you. Join our community. Oh, you need some money? Probably you had to leave a lot of your belongings and your money back. No problem. We have money. We'll help you with money. They give them money. Now, when they give them money, people feel obligated. Oh, you want to come to our house December 25th? You're inviting me, but I'm Jewish. But no, it's okay. No, come. No, of course, we're happy. Come December 25th. Come, you know, the other holidays, what have you. well, he gave me money, so I feel a little obligated. That's how it works. Okay? They are tremendous at that, and they target Jews who are in transition. Let's just take a few simple examples. Kids in college, are they in transition? Most kids? Sure, they're going from living at home to complete hefkeris, living out of college, far away, mixing, meeting people from all sorts of parts of the world in America, etc. The missionaries are huge on campus. That's why, for example, some different philanthropists are really targeting the campuses, you know, for the next 10 years or so as a key place to catch kids. They literally go to the bus stations. And you know what? Do they have Emmaus? Do they have Emmaus to sell, so to speak, as a product? No. So what do they come with? We love you and Yashki loves you. That's their message. We love you and Yashki loves you. And if you go back to my personal votive, Ha'oda Avichai, it kind of fits. That's a very powerful message. And I would contend that my experience is, if you come to a non-from Jew with two messages, Torah is Emes and you have to live it, or we love you, what are most people going to gravitate towards? As Rav Yaakov Weinberg itself said, Emes doesn't necessarily obligate people in this generation. They're going to gravitate towards the we love you. We love you, we care about you. We have to be real that goes on. So we have to focus on developing relationships and being normal with people. There's a great book out there called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Again, it's not Torah Messinai, but it's a very popular. I actually read a great article by Jonathan Rosenblum saying that these seminars, these Dale Carnegie training seminars, are very popular in Eretz Yisrael. And they're actually very, very popular even with Hasidim. Actually, my Rav's son, one of his sons, Aaron, went through one of these training courses. And it built up his self-confidence and it gave ability to speak to others. It's an unbelievable thing. It's really, really taking hold in Eretz Yisrael. Make a friend, have fun, and realize that when you meet somebody who's not from, your job is not to take them from 0 to 100. Your job, our job, is to be the conduit. Just to be the door opener, to let that person in. We have a connection to the from world. This person does not have a connection to that world. Some of those people want a connection to this world. All we do is open the door for them. We can hand them off to a website, to Rabbi Koren, to other people with experience, to Gateways, to Eishet Torah, to Partners in Torah, etc., etc. There are many, many, many resources that we can use and should use at our disposal. I want to ask a question, because I understand that from time to time, challenges are given out in this group of make a contact a day and email your experiences back to the Google group or what have you. Let's suppose that an announcement was made. I'm making an announcement tonight. Let's suppose. I'm not really, but let's suppose. Tomorrow, for every contact that each person in here makes, with a Jewish person, a positive Jewish contact, a philanthropist is going to give $1,000 cash to each person for as many contacts as they make, unlimited amount. You have 24 hours to do it. How many people in here think they can make at least one contact for $1,000 cash? How many think they'd make 5 contacts? How many would make 10 contacts? Okay. What's the point? The point is, if the value were so enormous, we'd forget about our fears. Can't do this, I can't do that. We're going to get into the fears in a second. But I just want you to be real with, it's not impossible. It's that we personally either have too much fear or we lack perceived value. So just like in our example with crossing the board, sometimes if you massively change one, you can completely change the results. There's a great sefer here by Aaron Unger, just written, published by Feldheim, called Putting Out the Fire, Your Unique Role in Bringing Jews Closer to Torah. This sefer talks a lot about the value and the perceived value of reaching out. Now, for tonight's talk, since we have limited time, I know that virtually everybody here is already aware of the problem, wants to be part of the solution. They're already participating. They're already doing something. So I'm not going to speak a whole lot about the perceived value of reaching out, about the statistics, et cetera, any more than I already have. But if somebody is hearing this year later or seeing it on a video, what have you, it's very, very important to try to build up in our own minds what the real perceived value is of reaching out. I want to tell you a great story just to give you an indication of something that can happen. About 2 months ago, I was in the dry cleaners here in Muncie. And a rav walks in, and I said, Shalom Aleichem, my name's Alan Proctor. Have we met? He says to me, we sure have. He smiles. He said, 2 years ago, we met here in Muncie, and you recruited me to be a mentor for Partners in Torah. And I want to let you know, you took my name and you submitted it to Partners in Torah, and we haven't spoken since. But right after that, Partners in Torah called me, and I've been learning on the telephone every week with a doctor in Chicago, and the doctor just told me last week that he's made a decision to put his son in yeshiva. So I got a big smile on my face. I said, oh, this is great. He said to me, you know, this is just like Amway, except Amway doesn't work. That's what he told me. And I said, oh, that's unbelievable. That's unbelievable that we can do something. I signed the guy up. I took his name, number, recruited him, whatever, gave it over. Boom. Every single person here can either be that mentor for Partners in Torah, can recruit other people for Partners in Torah. Gershon Fern and I were in shul today, and a gentleman who davens right next to me, I didn't even think about approaching him for Partners in Torah. And Gershon said, would you like to be a mentor for Partners in Torah? He said, yeah, you know, I'll do it. He's a chashuv attorney here in the Muncie area. So Gershon will get the schluss for that. I missed out on it. All I had to do was ask him. It's right there. And one more reason why I think it's very, very, very important that we reach out is that Hashem treats the Jewish people the way that we treat each other. Hashem treats the Jewish people the way that we treat each other. And Achdus protects. And with everything going on in the world today, I've got to believe that what our Tati and Shemayim wants from us is that all of his children should get along and should be involved in reaching out and trying to help each other. And therefore, that will give us a protection. Okay, I want to speak a little bit about some of the fears that people have. Now, I want to tell you the klal gadol of fears. The klal gadol of fears is, if you're afraid, if you find yourself, you're going to approach somebody, this and that, you're thinking about it, but you're afraid, it's because you're focused on yourself. If you're afraid, it's because you're focused on yourself and you're thinking about yourself. What if he says no? What if he thinks I'm coercing him? What if this? What if I say it wrong? What if that? We're going to get into these in a second. So, the great solution is take your focus off yourself and focus on the other person. Try to speak to them for their benefit. This is why we're not in sales. I don't like the word, we put on the flyer, sales 101. That's just to give you an idea that there are certain tools and techniques. We're not selling, we're sharing. We're sharing what we have. Some people are going to be interested in it. Some people aren't. Sometimes it's just timing. Okay? Number one fear that from this list that I compiled over here, this is not necessarily in any order. I don't think people will listen to me. Sometimes people feel, oh, the guy's not going to listen to me, person's not going to listen to me. Okay. So my answer is to that, the 10 to 20% will. The kid who just came back from birthright will. The person who's going through somewhat of a transition in their life, maybe they just got a new job, they just lost a job, they just had their first child and now they're starting to wonder about Judaism, they just got married, they're thinking about getting married, they just got unmarried. There's something going on in their life where there's a little bit of a Pesach. Their kid just became a bar mitzvah. Even if they're not from, there's a little bit of an opening. So don't focus on the ones who the timing isn't right for. Focus on that 10 or 20% where the timing is right, and it becomes much easier. Number two, I'll be viewed as coercing. I'll be viewed as missionizing a coworker. This is a very key one because a lot of people work with non-from people. My personal experience is the best way to perhaps be macabre or have an influence on non-from people that we work with is not to push at all. Even if that person is a subordinate and they'll have to take orders from you, let's say. They'll have to do what you tell them to do. The best way to do it is just be a mensch. Have excellent midos, treat them really nicely, and let them see from your example what it means to live a Torah life. If you do that, then when there's an opening, then when the person says to you, "Oh, Mr. Boss or Mr. Co-worker, I get a mazel tov," right? They know a few words. "I get a mazel tov. My son is having his bar mitzvah this weekend." "Oh, that's great." That gives you a little opening. You've been a mensch, you haven't pushed anything. Then you can ask him, "Do you know what it means to be a bar mitzvah? Would you like to? I saw a great vort on it. I have a little parsha sheet here. I have a little something I can send you." Or you send him a little gift, something like it. "What's your son's name?" Maybe you get invited. So however it happens to work out, there's a little opening there. If you pushed and you tried to press, because we got him a car, this person, he's another Jew, and this, they're never going to give you that opening. But if you don't, and you're just a mensch, especially, I'm primarily talking about in the work environment, where you have to see the same person day in, day out, year in, year out, you never want to get the person to a spot where they feel uncomfortable, to they feel, "Well, I better tell the boss or his boss that this guy's missionizing to me. He's made, that's a terrible chaloshim." And for every story that you hear about some guy macarved another guy that worked for him because he insisted that they, you know, that they do something kahalacha, there are 8 people in my experience that it worked the other way. He feels forced. He feels manipulated. We live there. There's this great study that came out from Charles Bronfman's group. It says, it's called Grande Soy Latte No Foam. Judaism in an age of unlimited choices. They're talking about, for those of you, I see many of the faces didn't exactly hop that. That's a drink that you can order at Starbucks. Most of us just get coffee, large, medium, small coffee. Grande Soy Latte No Foam is a certain type of way that they make the coffee. And the point is, there are so many choices. There are so many options open to people today that they want something open. Nobody wants, very few people want things shoved down their throat. Okay. Number 3 fear. If I fail, I'll make things worse. If I fail, I'll make things worse. My answer is, if you're sincere, you can't fail. If you're sincere, you can't fail. You're sincerely trying to share something to help another Jewish person live more Jewishly. That's it. If the timing is not right, timing is not right. Number 4. I'm worried about making a chilul Hashem. Could be at work, could be on the subway, could be wherever it's going to be. Again, if you don't missionize, if you don't look at it like I got to sell the guy, and if you focus on Avos Yisrael, that I love this other Jewish person, that Hashem loves this other Jewish person, I'm trying to do it. I want to love this person. This person is a brother, and that could be me in that circumstance. If we focus on that and we take our eyes off of ourselves, then we're going to be fine. Number 5, we don't have enough knowledge. Sometimes people say, I used to be the mentor recruiter for Partners in Torah. And I'd go to from people and ask them, could you be a mentor for Partners in Torah 1 hour a week? So I'd hear different excuses. Sometimes people would say, you know, I don't know enough. I don't have enough knowledge. I would say, do you know the Aleph Beis? Yeah. Do you know the holidays? Yeah. So you already know more than 80 or 90% of American Jewry. Oh, really? And I'll tell you something else. If somebody asks you a question that you don't know the answer to, and it's a good question, the best answer is, I don't know. That's a good question. Let me try to look it up, or let's look it up together, or let's research it together, or let's go online together, and let's see if we can discover an answer. What does that do? Most importantly, that tells the non-frum Jew, I don't know everything. Orthodox Jews don't know everything. They don't have all the answers. Because the more that the non-frum person feels, you know everything and I know nothing, the gap is just so great, they think, why should I even try? I'll never get there. But if they see, this guy admits he doesn't know everything, then we've got a little bit of a Pesach maybe to get there. Number 6, I'm an average frum Jew and will never be able to relate to anybody. I grew up in yeshiva. I know about the yeshiva world. I don't know about everything else. My answer is, if you're out in the world, you meet the guy on an airplane or what have you, just be normal. Talk about normal things. What's the most common topic people speak about in an elevator? Jewish, non-Jewish, it doesn't matter. The most common topic is the weather. Is it raining? You just came from the outside. It's snowing, it's raining, it's cold, it's hot, it's going to rain, this, that. People just... They want to break the tension. They want to break the ice instead of just staring. Right? So they talk about the weather. Just talk about something par. You can talk about the weather even if you grew up in yeshiva your whole life. Talk about something normal. It breaks the tension. And the key is the first couple of little steps to break the tension. Okay. Number 7. I can't make anybody from. This is a great one. I always tell people, you are exactly right. Nobody can make anybody from, especially somebody that doesn't want to be made from. We can help them grow in Torah. We can lead them to sources, to people, to Rebbeim, to Shiurim, etc., like that. There's a great expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? But there's another part of that expression that they never talk about. But you can make him thirsty. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, but you can make him thirsty. How do you make a horse thirsty? You feed him salt. And then he wants water. He's going to look for water. Or you feed him hay, something like that, that's going to make him want the water, right? So how do you do that? You ask sincere questions. Number 8, I'm too busy. It's a huge commitment. That's being makar of another person, having an influence, not even using the word makar, just having a positive influence on a Jew to help them grow a little bit closer to Torah is just an awareness. It's just an awareness of I'm looking for people who are looking for me. We are looking for people who are looking for me, who are looking for us. I want to tell you a couple of quick little stories, some of my favorite stories. Let's say somebody came in and said, there's a 3-year-old kid outside. He says he's upset at you and he's going to get you. So how many of us would be afraid? Well, a 3-year-old kid, what's he going to do? Kick me in the shin? But then let's say the guy comes running. Another guy comes running and he says, you know that 3-year-old kid that's upset outside? He's got a loaded gun. Now how many people are afraid? Everybody's afraid, right? Are we afraid of the kid? No, we're afraid of the gun. We're afraid of the vehicle. That's Lahavdil, that's Torah. It's not us. We're the 3-year-old kid, maybe. Maybe we're new to the firm world. Maybe we've been in yeshivas our whole life. Maybe we don't know how to talk to people. Torah is the loaded gun. Torah is the weapon. It's extremely powerful. Don't underestimate it. I'm going to share a couple of great lines, what I call one-punch knockout lines, that I've heard over the years. These are a couple of little war stories. I hope you'll enjoy them. The greatest one-punch knockout line I ever heard in Kirov was the following. Rabbi Mucky Berger, who's a giant in Kirov, works for Eishet Torah in Yerushalayim. There was a young man named Jay Bragg. Jay Bragg was working for the Democratic National Committee in Washington, and he came to study at Eish for a few weeks. And a very nice guy, very nice young man. He came there, took a look. It's very interesting. Judaism is very nice, but, you know, I'm going back to the Democratic National Committee, and we're doing great things to change the world. So Rabbi Mucky looks at him and says, okay. He says, let me ask you one question, though. The mission of the Jewish people is to be a light to the nations. Why work for the nations when you can work for the light? It hit Jay right between the eyes. Today he's a rabbi. A rabbi raising a firm family. One line turned him around. I remember, in my process, I remember going to Rabbi Yehuda Ferris, a Chabad rabbi in Berkeley, California, where I have a lot of Hakor Satov too. I said, Rabbi Ferris, I don't know how much I'm going to grow in this Orthodox thing. I'm starting late and this and that. Even if I become Orthodox, my kids, they're going to know more than me at a very young age. So, you know, basically, why even bother type of thing. He said to me, let me tell you something. Even a blind person can give birth to a sighted one. Even a blind person can give birth to a sighted one. I remember thinking, that's unbelievable. He just told me, my kids, Baruch Hashem, we're 3 little kids, they're FFPs, right? I'm a BT, they're FFPs. You never know the person that you're going to have an influence on, like I spoke about the doctor who's decided to put his son in yeshiva. You never know. It may not be that person that you're speaking with that becomes Shomer Torah and Mitzvahs and moves to Me'ah Shearim Yerushalayim, but maybe their kids, or maybe their nephew, or maybe their cousin, or maybe that guy decides he becomes a little bit warmer to Yiddishkeit and he gives tzedakah. And he was going to give to this, donation to this parv institution of the aquarium, but he likes you and he sort of hears it, so he's going to give it to this Jewish cause over here, to poor people in Israel. You know what a schus that is? To just turn a person just a little bit. Sometimes it doesn't take that much. 8 common questions. I received some questions before tonight's talk, And I'm going to answer these 8 common questions, and then we'll have a few minutes to open it up for questions from the audience. And I'm going to end with a story before we get to questions from the audience. Number 1, what's the best way to establish rapport with someone? My answer, be sincerely interested. There's a great expression that says, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Number 2, what do I need to do to keep the relationship going? Okay, I've met him. How do I keep it going? So there's another great expression. It says, selling is not telling. Now, this is not selling. Again, it's sharing. We're using selling as a generic word tonight. Selling is not telling. Selling is asking questions. Okay, let me give you a simple example. Let's suppose, we've all had this example. We want to buy a suit. So we walk into Macy's. What do most salespeople in Macy's do? They walk over and they say, hi, how are you? Hi, how's the weather? Good, how's, nice to see you. Nice day, is this, day? Good. Okay, my name's Joe. If you need anything, I'm over here. Okay, thanks, Joe. You remember, if you're going to buy something, Joe, right, I'll ring you up, right, because he wants the commission, right? I'll ring you up, and Joe, I'm over here. Good, thank you, Joe. Okay, we just move away from Joe, right? Now, what does the smart salesperson do? They walk in, and the customer walks into the suit section, and he says, hi, how are you? Very good. You say, have you found what you're looking for? No. What are you looking for? A suit. For a formal occasion or for business? A formal occasion. You want a tuxedo or you want a fancy dress suit? A tuxedo. You like black or you like dark blue? I like black. You like felt or you like a shiny? I like the shiny. You see what I'm doing? And he walks them through. Okay, then he shows him the suit. After they get the right suit, he doesn't just let him go. He says, do you have a shirt for that? I was going to wear my regular business shirt. No, he says, pardon me, but it doesn't exactly go. If you have a tuxedo, you need a tuxedo shirt with the little lapels. Oh, I need one? Okay, good. So let's go over here. You like a frilly one or do you like a straight one? Oh, I like the frilly one. Okay, so they go through that whole thing. Then, do you have a tie for it? Well, can I wear this tie? No, it doesn't go like that. You need a bow tie. Okay, you like black or you like red? I like black. Okay, you like this kind or that kind? Well, you have cufflinks. Well, I was going to wear these cufflinks. Well, you need fancy or dressy. Okay, the cufflinks. Well, you go through the whole thing. And what shoes are you going to wear with that? Well, I was going to wear these shoes. Don't they work? Well, you could get away with it, but really it's a fancy tie. You have to get, they have these shiny shoes. Okay, you like this or you like that? You have a belt that matches that because the belt has to match the shoes, right? And you go through the whole part. The guy walks out. Now, is the customer upset when he walks out and he just spent $1,000 thinking he just needed a suit, but his suit was $500, but he spent $500 on all this other stuff? No. He walks out and he says to himself, oh, I'm ready. I look good. This guy, he's got me dialed in. I'm not going to be embarrassed. I'm going to be one of the chashuv people over there, and I'm happy. He walks in and he feels happy that he spent all this money. And the salesperson made a lot of money. So what's the point? If we're sincerely interested in helping people get what they want, this guy's neshama wants a connection to Torah. He wants something. He doesn't know what he wants, but his neshama craves to reconnect to its source from where it came, before he was alive and where it's going to go back in. So as long as we know how to guide him and how to direct him with sort of these questions, did we push anything on the guy? We didn't push. Selling is not telling. Selling is asking questions. Okay. Number 3, if I feel those jitters, what can I do to relax myself? So again, if you're afraid, it's because you're focused on yourself. So I would say, just be yourself, relax, and have fun with it. No pressure. Number 4, I want to plan for the worst. What's the worst that could happen? What's the worst case scenario that could happen if I start to talk to this guy? So I thought about this and decided probably the worst that could happen is the guy thinks that you're weird and you're missionizing him and you're attacking him and he feels very on the defensive. So what's the solution for that? Just be sincere. If you're sincere, we know words that come from the heart go into the heart. If a person's sincere, that comes across. And there's not going to be any negative fallout from that. Number 5, how do I come across as sincere and not appear manipulative? The answer, ask questions. In our suit salesman question, was the suit salesman in our example, did he seem really manipulative? No, he seemed really interested. Of course he wanted the commission. I mean, it's obvious, that's why he's in sales, right? But he was really interested in helping that client get what they really needed, what they wanted, by understanding what that person's needs were. Almost like at the beginning, we talked about the air conditioner salesman, okay? Instead of trying to push air conditioning, which that's selling ice to Eskimos, so to speak, we had to find out, think about what do they really want. Remember, we're not selling, we're just sharing, and we're looking for that 10 to 20%. We are looking for those people who are looking for us. One great question you could ask somebody, whether they're in your work environment or wherever they happen to be, is there something in Judaism that you'd like to know more about? Now, that's a pretty delicate, gentle question, isn't it? Anybody going to get bent out of shape if you ask him that question? Maybe you're sitting on a plane with a guy. He sees that you're Orthodox. He's not Orthodox. He sees you eating the kosher meal, you're davening, what have you. You can say, is there something in Judaism you'd like to know more about? He might say, you know, in fact, my daughter, I remember this is the example. I see him. In fact, my daughter's going to have a bas mitzvah. You know, can we talk about that? Sure. Or, you know, we're just about to have our first child. What does Judaism say about raising children? Or it's Passover coming up, isn't it? Why do we eat the matzah? Or if you ask them the question, you'll generally get something that they're interested in. Go back to the suit salesman. Is there something in Judaism you'd like to know more about? Okay. If you give them a book or a tape to read or listen to or a website or something, when you follow up with them, I found the best question to ask people on the follow-up is, what did you like best about it? What did you like best about it? Not like, oh yeah, you want to become from? No. What did you like best about it? Why? Because as Tony Robbins says, the quality of questions that we ask ourselves is the quality of life we get. Okay? If you ask somebody, what did you like best about it, you're going to get a positive answer. If someone eats a whole meal at a restaurant, the whole thing was terrible, but the friend says, oh, you went there, what did you like best about it? He's forced to think, oh, I didn't like this, I didn't like this. The bread was pretty good. That was pretty good. So you get some sort of a positive, and we want to build on positive. Number six, if I fail, how do I prepare myself for the next time? So I'd say simply, forget the past, speak positive, and expect great things. Forget the past, speak positive, and expect great things. Number seven, what's the best Kirov program you've been involved with and why? I'm definitely no Gaya Bedover. I would personally say Partners in Torah, I find, is a tremendous program. About 13,000 people learning every week now through Partners in Torah, 6,500 sets of chavrusas. I feel it's so unbelievable because it's pre-selected. So if you have a frum person that says, I'd like to do something, I'm willing to do something, maybe it's even a housewife. She's not going out and going to meet the non-frum people in the arena out there. But she can take a partner in Torah 1 hour a week over the phone, study what she wants, when she wants, and the achdus that's generated is tremendous. The barriers that are removed when two Jewish people, especially two very different Jewish people, are learning Torah together is unbelievable. If you put them together in a normal situation, what do you think of the state of Israel? Well, what do you think of it? Well, I think that people shouldn't be on unemployment. They should be. They're big families, this, that. All these issues are going to come up. But if you say, no, let's not talk about that. Let's just learn Torah together. Let's learn Pirkei Avos. Let's learn Shabbos. Let's learn Kashrus. Let's learn Hashkafa. Whatever it is, Chumash, whatever it happens to be, then it breaks down barriers and friendships and relationships are formed. Number eight, I can't say I'm so excited about Yiddishkeit, even though I know it's important. Can I still be involved with Kirov? Okay, great question. So I want to tell you an amazing story. And I asked the Rosh Yeshiva this question myself to confirm it. In 1980, I believe, Rabati Berger, again from Eshet Torah, went to Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky Shlita, asking that the Rosh Yeshiva should sign a haskama that the frum world should be supportive and involved with Kirov. And the Rosh Yeshiva said to Rav Mati, I will sign your haskama, but I want to let you know something. I am not signing on behalf of the non-frum, I am signing on behalf of the frum. Because the frum come out of yeshiva and they have no more sipuk. And this, when they get involved with a non-frum person, it invigorates them, it fires them up, it gets their juices flowing, helps them question things, they have to understand things and say things that they maybe have done for years, lighting Shabbos candles or what have you, it forces them to really understand what they're doing. And I saw a great vort that drives this point home, and we'll finish with this, and then we'll open it up for questions for however long we have. Rabbi Zev Leff says, He asks a question. Why does the first bracha of Shemone Esrei end with Magen Avraham? Why doesn't it end Magen Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? So Rabbi Leff said that there have been times in Jewish history when there were people like Avraham Avinu, neither whose parents nor grandparents were from. Then there were times when people were like Yitzchak Avinu, when their parents, but not their grandparents, were from. And then there were times when, like Yaakov Avinu, when both their parents and their grandparents were from. Rabbi Leff says that you would think that when Jewish history reaches its climax, right before Mashiach, that all three types of people will be represented in Klal Yisrael. He said, in the name of Rav Shimon Shkop, he said, Rav Shkop says, but it's not going to be that way. Rav Shkop says, the time right before Mashiach, the tests and trials of the secular world are going to be so great. The doubts that people go through in their life, just from what they see, are going to be so strong on a person's mind that every single person is going to have to find it within themselves, the koyach, to be an Avraham Avinu. That yichus alone won't save somebody. Just being from an FFB family, so to speak, even for generations and generations, it's not going to save someone. Every single Jewish person, whether they're today from, non-from, they've always been from, whatever, they're going to have to dig deep inside of themselves and find the emunah and betachon to be an Avraham Avinu. So if you want chizuk, if you need chizuk, go mechazik another Jew, and your life will never be the same. With that, I'd be very happy to take questions. Right. That's always the first question is the hardest because everybody has the fear factor. Usually once somebody starts to ask a question, then it opens up. Please. Comment, sure.
First, thank you. You're a wonderful presentation. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I had a personal experience very recently about August. I came back from Israel, and a non-from couple sitting near me. The wife was reading a book, and the husband, you know, I started having a conversation, and he asked me a lot of things about the Orthodox Judaism, just general questions. And all of a sudden, so it was like 3 or 4 hours, you were already speaking. And the wife asked, well, why are you speaking? You speak about Judaism, tries to make you the Orthodox. So he said, no, you know, I'm just asking you, explain me. So I took his number, and kind of, you know, became close. Before Hanukkah, I sent him some cookies, and I invited him to come to my house for one night, and he refused it. He said he can't come.
Wow. Yashar Koyach. So for those of you who weren't able to hear it, or if somebody's watching the video or hearing the tape, this young man said that on an airplane he met a couple and he was schmoozing with the husband for 3 or 4 hours, just answering the guy's questions about Judaism, not pushing, not prodding. And a few months later came Hanukkah time, so this young man sent him some cookies and invited him to his house to come over for a night. And the man said, I'm sorry, I can't come. But then the man called back a week later and asked if he could come and he could bring his wife and his children for Shabbos. Absolutely. That's part of the 10 to 20% who are out there looking. You were just obviously very open, very non-judgmental, which is such a big key. Good question, guys?
Well, yeah, just on the point about people looking, I think the main part of the problem is people don't realize how empty their lives are by virtue of the fact that they have a Nishmas Yisrael. And we want to give the right opportunity to open that spark up. It seems like if we need to wait for that to happen, then we may not have that opportunity.
So one of the ways you can do that is by asking questions. The question is, if you know somebody, meet somebody, is there a way that we can sort of speed up the process and not just wait for life to open them up, so to speak? The best thing that I can think of is, again, by asking questions, and maybe ask them that question. Is there something about Judaism that you'd like to know more about? You know, he sees the Yarmulke, and then perhaps you're going to find an opening there. We have 1 minute of tape left, so we have maybe one or two more quick questions.
I was going to ask, what's the most commonly asked is, let's say someone's part of the Google group or whatever group do we have, and now it says, okay, I got to do my 10 minutes this week. And there's value to that, of course, that it's mechuyev to do that, otherwise you may not do anything. What is, so to speak, a good suggestion? You know, okay, so I have, so he knows someone, let's say an aunt somewhere out there in, you know, in New Jersey. What would be the best beginning, so to speak, approach to reach out for that week? You know, is it to call and say hi? Is it to send an email from Aish with a nice article? There's different options, but I think that's one of the struggles that many people have when they don't have a pool, so to speak, of many non-Jewish people.
So the answer, the question was, should they reach out to a relative or something? They can certainly reach out to the relative. They can call them. They can just start to befriend them, etc. But eventually, they're going to run out of relatives and, you know, people right around there. Just a quick story. What I learned in recruiting for partners in Torah, one Sukkos, I went to Hershey Park, and I wanted to recruit from people to be a mentor. And I was people were running and this and going on this ride and that ride. And finally, I stopped and I looked around. I was in the food court tent, and I saw a whole line of guys just standing there. What are they doing? Oh, they're waiting for Netilas Yadayim. There's one sink. There's a whole long line. I just walked right up to the line, and I went to the back of the line, and I started schmoozing with guys. And I had like 3 or 4 minutes to talk to them. What's the point? Catch a person when they're relaxed. Catch them when they're relaxed. So if you go to a lunch, something at lunch, or you're waiting in line at the airport, wherever you happen to be, where people are just relaxed, they're just hanging out, they're comfortable. That's a great informal place to just start up a conversation with somebody. Thank you very much. A lot of hatzlacha to everybody.
Tremendous. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Can we have a volunteer from Arab? Anyone who has a chiyuv or wants to daven?
Low batteries.